Okay, so this is a methodology pointer too. And based upon the ideas that came up yesterday, I wanted to expand and develop the methodology ideas. Okay, so there's really three points that are kind of related. The first one is I just want to distinguish between two types of methodology. So I when we speak about the term, like it's a term we kind of throw around a little bit just to maybe make a hakira methodology. So one is I would call it like the methodology of creative intuition, okay? And that's the methodology and like how to arrive at a concept. And it's a process, and again, I'm not gonna go into like the details. I more wanted to give more a broad overview. But like it's one idea is the process by which you come up with an idea. How do you arrive at an idea? So for example, the ideas like we said before, like sometimes you gather the facts, you have to try to get all the facts in the sigil. We discussed that before. Sometimes you want to sit and think about a particular problem, try to identify main problem, see if, or the different problems. And different thinkers are different ways. I like to gather the facts and let the ideas, throw them around in my head. And sometimes, it takes me a week or two or whatever it is. Sometimes, different areas, especially in Chumash, the idea will come to me in a year or two later, a couple of years later. Sometimes you just gotta lay the groundwork and then your mind works on it. It could also be like, you'll see the idea from, you never know where the idea emerges from. But that's what I would say is like the methodology of creative intuition. It's in terms of you're trying to develop over time an intuition of how to come up with an idea, how to get a concept. Okay. That's like one major thing you're trying to develop in learning. And the process is by learning yourself. I think that's the most important thing. Preparing for Shir in advance, trying to come up with an idea in preparation for Shir. But also in when you really have to set up chavrusas, if you want to learn how to learn and come up with ideas, you have to really set up chavrusas and do it yourself. And I think in a certain sense, to a lesser degree in this stage, it's like seeing the fully worked out idea. Okay. That's kind of a little bit the point I want to get to. It's like when you see the fully worked out idea by your Rebbe, or when you read a piece in the Grizz or a Chaim or the Rav or something like that, and you read a fully worked out piece, it's you seeing an idea. And it's helpful to see ideas, to see what a fully worked out idea sounds like, how it looks. And you need to have those concepts. And that does guide your intuition and help you. But to some degree, there's this, I don't want to say, I'm using the term very loosely, but there's a certain dishonesty when you see a shir presented, when it's a fully worked out piece, or you read a piece by one of the briskers. I think there's a certain element of and I'm saying very loosely, of dishonesty, because the way you present an idea is not necessarily the way that the idea is arrived at in the process of learning and intuition. Okay. And that brings me to the second type of methodology. I was thinking it's like, again, for lack of better terms, I was thinking of calling it the methodology of like analytical steps. So the steps that you take to build an idea, how one idea leads to the other. So that's much more like, I think the way a shir is presented or a piece of Torah, a brisker piece of Torah is presented. It's presented by like logical steps. This is the problem in the Rambam. This is this Gemara. You have an implication from this Gemara for this step. Logically, if you say step A, now you have forcing to say step B. That creates a new problem with this other Gemara. Now we have to resolve it. It's muchach. The only way to resolve it is by saying this point. Okay, and it becomes a beautiful piece of Torah, paragraph by paragraph and step by step. And you see how like the ideas are compelling and one follows from the other. And that's an idea of like logical consistency and how really each step really, really gives rise to the next step. But that's not, I think like sometimes you're able to think that way. And the truth is, I don't want to generalize too much because I'm not really sure. It's very hard for me to know. It's hard to know what's unique to, I don't say unique, what's particular to me and what's general and universal about everybody. But I think it's like, I mean, I think to some degrees, I would say it's a mix. Sometimes you have SARS through the analytical step-by-step method, and sometimes you do it through this creative intuition method. And they're different, but almost, okay. I shouldn't say almost always. And then I think using that hakira, there's two types of shears that you can have, you can go to, okay? Two types of rebbeim. So sometimes you'll get a rebbe who's presenting a fully worked out piece of Torah. They prepare extensively in advance. They've worked it all out step by step, and they present it. And it's much more like, I say, for example, like Rabbi Reichman. I only went to the first one that he gave. But he's giving you the Rishimos. Like, you know what I mean? He's like giving over, at least in that year, that's what he was doing. He's giving over the Rishimos. They were step-by-step worked out things from the Rav, and he's presenting it. And yes, you can ask questions in between, but you're seeing the beauty and the consistency of an idea unfolding as it logically does. And there's tremendous value in that. That's one type of shear. Another type of shear, and this is much closer to what my rabbi does, right? You know, and it's kind of what I'm trying to emulate to some degree, is where the shear is not fully worked out in advance. You know, I come in. I think Rav Pesach's also like this a little. I don't know when I was in the shear, it was like this, rabbi for sure. They give some sort of idea of what you want to say, usually, not necessarily always, but some sort of concept of where you want to go with the svara. But then basically in the shear, you almost in a certain sense start afresh. You read the Gemara, you see the Rashi, you see the Tosos, but realize the problem, think about it again, and you haven't really worked it out. And sometimes, you know, you come in and you end up saying something very different than you originally thought about, or you get onto a problem that you hadn't even really prepared for, and you get to see the learning process itself in terms of coming up with an idea. And I say each style of shear has its value. You know, the process of seeing your Rebbe learn has the value of like, it makes it a little bit more realistic in terms of you learning and benefiting on that process of the creative intuition, how to guide, how to come up with an idea. It's much more realistic in terms of when you're learning on your own, it's going to parallel much more that style of shear of that's what learning looks like, trying to come up with an idea on your own. On the other hand, that's a messier style of shear. It's a lot messier. You say an idea, it doesn't really work out. You end up with something else. Then you say something that seems quite opposite. Sometimes you end up, you know, you don't know what to say. Things don't work out at all. So that's the reality of learning. On the other hand, you don't always get the beautifully packaged idea. And there is something to be said from reading a piece from the Rav or a Rebbe who comes in a lecture style shear, present the Euro. You're guaranteed to have a good shear every time. You're guaranteed to have a solid idea because you prepared for an advance. If you didn't have an idea, you'd think longer, you know, prepare for another hour or two until you get something solid. And then you get to see like the logical flow of ideas in a straight line, as opposed to where the first style, the more the creative intuition style, it's like kind of all over the place and it's much messier. So I just think, again, it's like important just at least to distinguish when we speak about methodology, there's these different frameworks. One is like coming up with the idea, and then the logical flow of the idea itself once you have the idea. Do you know that's two different things? And very often you'll come up with the idea in this messy, helter-skelter way, but then when you present it, so even when I come in this year, I'm not, especially the more I prepare in advance, the more when I come into this year, I already have I have a way of how the idea on its own flows and emerges. And I'm presenting it in a, like I'm calling it dishonest. I don't mean it that way, but it's dishonest in terms of the learning process. It's honest. It's more honest and true to the idea itself. There's an internal flow and logic of the idea, and that's how I'll present it if I've really worked it out in advance. Okay. So there are these two different areas of methodology, the methodology of the flow of idea internally, and then there's the methodology of the thought process, the intuition of the learner trying to come up with an idea. Okay. Yeah, I guess in the second point, I guess I really included in the first point. You know, I already wrote on the notes, though. This is what happens when you prepare. But I guess it's just developing the point maybe a little different. Of course, it could be I'm just going to be repeating what I said. So the second point is just the idea of the bidirectionality of svaras and like the problems. Okay, so it's that sometimes the svara emerges from the problem. Where you see the problems in the sugya, try to identify the main problem, what's the most likely to give you the idea, and you try to follow the problems, the facts of the sugya, and the problems of the sugya. You try to follow that towards the concept, towards the idea. That's one kind of a process. And I would say, in general, that's maybe at the end, I'm going to have to try to distinguish what I was saying originally from this, because it's a little difference, a little contradiction, but maybe I'll work it out why it's not. I think in general, that's how I do learn. You know, that's how you learn, is you go through the facts, try to gather them, see the problems, and identify the core problems. You have to have a certain intuition. What is the core problem? I don't know if there's exactly, simple rule you can use. To some degree, it depends upon your there's a subjective element, and then, you know, your level of learning to figure out what's the main problem, what's not the main problem. And realize, you know, what are the core issues you have to define, and then try to work on it and try to solve it and kind of directly go to it from the facts to the problem to the svara. Okay. Then there's a different approach. I don't think I take it as much. I noticed I kind of did a little bit yesterday. That's why it's interesting. And I think, like, for example, I know we haven't discussed like the master key problem. Maybe this comes up with it a little bit. Maybe I'll bring in the whole master key idea. But sometimes you just take a look at an area, and you you can go through the facts, understand that, you know, basically understand the idea, but then you just try to think in the area of like the different possible ways that a thing can be formulated. Okay. And you come up with like the broader chakiras, the broader distinctions and possibilities and the potential ways of going within the area, just by, in a sense, letting your mind be free to wander around the area and to think about it and to see the different possible chilukim and possible ways that a thing could be formulated, right? So, for example, like kind of how we ended up this year last time, we asked the question of what the Gemara knows, the Arba Dvarim, Yerchayev, and Ripo Sheves, Tzaren Boshes. It's when you, on your own, when there is no nezek, there is no all the damages. Now the Gemara wants to know that even when there is nezek, how do you know you're also chayiv in the arba dvarim also, right? So we said there's two ways you can think about that, right? Either you can look at it, the Torah's just said, the Torah's chiddush is that these four things are completely independent. They have nothing to do with nezek. So you're chayiv in both situations. And that's what the riboy is teaching you. You're always chayiv, one way to look at it. Or you can look at it is that basically you're chayiv twice. You're chayiv Shalob and Makom Nezek, and then there's a reboy to Mechayev you again, but Makom Nezek, but in a certain sense, the Maskana maintains both, there's like two Chayuvim, in a sense, Shalob and Makom Nezek and Makom Nezek. Okay, and that's like a Chakir of how the Torah formulated the idea that your Chayev Arba Dvarim, Shalob and Makom Nezek, and Makom Nezek. Right, is it one Chayuv which is not nothing to do with Nezek, or basically your Chayev in both cases? Okay, so that's like, in a sense, that's a hakira you could have come up with without really seeing, going through the sugya, without going through any of the facts. You can think about that. And like I said, I think like I haven't done that much of Aaron Lichtenstein, but like it seemed to me when I read it, you know, the few pieces that I've read, he kind of like did that in the beginning of his pieces, like comes up with these broad hakiras of different ways of looking at the area, thinking about it. And then afterwards, then you go to the sugya and the particulars and you see, can I apply it and can I not apply it? Okay, as opposed to having the svara emerge from the particular sugya on the facts and the problems and see what you come up with. It's more thinking about the broader area and trying to see all the different possibilities in your head, and then afterwards trying to apply that svara down to the actual sugya itself. So I think that there is this two methodologies. Again, I would think different people are more, more of an inclination to go one direction or the other. Depends upon the type of thinker you are. And I don't think there's a hard and fast rule. Like I would say in general, I'm more the person, I go from the facts and the problem to the svara. But for example, yesterday I kind of did something the opposite or I went the other way. So it's not all or nothing. You don't have to choose all or nothing. Different maybe sugyas lend themselves to different ways of thinking. It depends upon the mood you're in. There's just different methods of trying to arrive at a svara that explains the sugya, starting from the facts and going to the universal, or in a sense, starting from the universals and then trying to bring it back down to the facts. Okay, I'm going to take up the master key problem a little bit. That's the next point, but that's the other second point I want to mention is this the fact that there's two directions you can go in when you're learning, where you're starting from and where you're ending up in. Yeah. So Zev is asking if I do both in the same sugya. So yeah, I mean, I think so. I think in a certain sense, there's just like, you know, it's like, I don't know what a great mashal is, but like, you know, if you're trying to, let's say, you know, dig somewhere. So, you know, there's two sides. You can start on one side and try to go all the way through. You can start on the other side and try to go all the way through. Or you can try to, you know, start on one side, see, you know, once you hit resistance, then go to the other side and start working there and see if you can meet somewhere in the middle. So like, yeah, I don't think there's any, even in one sugya, you know, you could start on one side. And if you run into resistance and you can't get anywhere, then you could just like sit back and you can start thinking a little bit and think about more universally and see if that works and brings you down. And you can go back and forth. I you know, I think there is, I just like you can, different people are more inclined to do one way or the other. And I think even the same person, some sugyas they'll approach one way or the other. I think even in one sugya itself, there's nothing that to say that you can't switch off. To some degree, that's what happened yesterday, I think. I kind of wanted to go further. And then I couldn't really go further through the just, you know, from the facts and the problem itself. I wasn't able to really go further. So I took a step back and tried to think and saw what I came up with. Oh yeah, and I think in the end of the day, it didn't really work, which we'll get to. That's my last point that I want to make today is like the problem with doing that, you know, the danger of going from the universal to the particular, but leaving that aside. Yeah, I don't see any problem with that of starting in one direction. And then if it doesn't really work, then go and use the other methodology. There's no hard and fast rule of which is necessarily better, which is worse. You have to at least identify, I would think it's helpful to identify what you're doing. So you can be aware of the like the dangers and the limitations of the approach that you're using. But like, you know, to be perfectly honest, you don't even really, once you develop, you know, you start learning, you don't really think about how you're learning, which method am I using. It's not, I don't think about this. When I'm learning, I'm not thinking about, am I using methodology A of the creative intuition, methodology B, analytical step. I'm not thinking about that. I'm just, you know, just learning. And sometimes I do one, sometimes I do the other. It becomes intuitive and you switch off. I'm more just like trying to break it down so I can give it over to you guys and explain it and you can ask questions and see. But at some point it just becomes, you know, second nature. That's how you think in your mind. Just like there's an intuition in like coming up with a svara, there's also intuition of which methodology to apply. It's like everything becomes intuitive. It just like, you know, it's like intuitive I use in the, you know, it's one of those words that's a little bit vague, but it's just such a good word, you know, because it's so vague. The point is it becomes like there's no hard and fast rule. And like, you have to kind of trust your mind as you learn in order to select how to do these things. And definitely switching between different methods, nothing intrinsically wrong with it. They're just two ways you're trying to, at the end of the day, the idea has got to be sound. It's got to be a sound idea, makes sense. And it's got to explain the facts and fit them. And, you know, some, you know, a certain criteria that you're looking for, and it doesn't really matter how you get to it exactly, you know? But yeah, again, I don't think there's any problem switching off in a sugya. Okay. So the last thing is just in terms of why you would want to apply one versus the other. Okay. So I think really, ideally, in a perfect world, you would always use the methodology of, you know, solid analytical steps from the flow of ideas themselves. Okay, I think that would be the ideal way. It's just the problem is like, it's just hard because that's the flow that's internal to the idea itself. And like, you only almost know that after the fact. You don't really know. It's 2020, it's hindsight. It's like once you get to the top of the mountain, then you look down and you see, well, that was the perfect path to take, you know, but like going forward, it's just like there's, you know, bushes and it's messy and it's, you know, there's obstacles and you don't have good vision and it's cloudy. You have problems seeing the proper path. It's just once you get to the final destination, you can look back and it becomes all clear. And that's how you present the flow of the idea internally. So, but like ideally, yeah, it'd be great if you could really step by step, each step led to the next, and you're able to follow that perfectly all the way up the mountain to the svara. That's like perfect because you stick with the idea, stick with the internal logic of the idea itself, and you're always directing the wrong way, never make any wrong turns. Okay. The problem with that method is that you don't always know the next step. You know, A, you make wrong turns, you know, that's not really the problem. That's fine. You make wrong turns and you backtrack and, you know, go forward. The real problem is you just don't always know where the next step is. And just very often in that method, you just get stuck. Okay. That's like, that's the problem. But I think in general, for me, I try to at least, like I said, I try to start off with that as far as I can go. I want to take that method as far as I can go. Get the facts, see the main problems, think about it. What steps do you have to say? Things like that. As much solid ground, as far up the mountain as you can get with a solid step by step. I that's what I want to do, and that's how far I want to go, for sure. Fine. Okay. That's what I think really the problem is. But you know, that's how I start. But like I said, I from Rav Aaron Lechtinsky, and I remember also the Rav in the beginning of, I think it was in the Rishimos, the beginning of Vamos or something. It didn't sound like he did that way. Again, you don't really know how somebody presents something, but the way the Rav Aaron Lechtinsky is far more written, it just sounds like he starts off, he doesn't start off with that method. It sounds like he starts off with the other method of trying to, when you approach an area, you think about the universals and the master keys and the things like that. Okay, well, we're talking about the master keys. Let me just develop that point. It's like a very important point, and it really touches on this this idea. So the idea of the master key problem is that when you do just think about an area, you often find like the broadest, most general ways of conceiving of a sugya, which is good, and you should be aware of what the broad hakiras in the sugya are. Okay. Let me give you a couple examples. Okay, for example, whenever you're doing a sugya of shutfus, okay, the broch, you always can ask this question. Okay, well, forget the particulars. The problem with, okay, well, once I have the particulars. So shutfus, you could look at shutfus. People make a partnership. You could look at it, they buy an animal. Okay, you could look at it in one and two voice. Either you know each one owns the whole animal. They each own the entire animal. But therefore they can't sell it without the other one because the other person's ownership prevents them from selling it. But even though I own the whole animal and you own the whole animal, I still can't act like a full baal because your ownership prevents me from doing that. And that's how you work out shutfus. Or you could say, no, we each own half the animal. Now, which half do we own? Okay, obviously there's no chalukah. We haven't split it up yet. So each and every part of the animal, conceptually, we each own half of it. So do we each have partial bialis? And therefore, we're limited in what we can do. We can't sell without the other because we each have partial bialis. It can't be whatever. Or do you say that, no, we each have full bialis, but the problem is your full bialis impedes my ability to realize my full bialis. Okay? So some version of that hakira in shutfus is always available. I'll explain what I mean by that. Or in chomish, you're doing a sugya of a chomish, where there's a karen, there's a base amount, and you have to add a chomish, either because you're nishbal sheker or because of me'ilai. I think me'ilai adds a chomish, I think so. Mila has a chomesh. There's certain areas where you have to add a chomesh to you have to add a fifth to for kapara, whatever, for other reasons. So you always have a question: is the chomesh like a separate payment? There's the basic karen of $100. Then you add the $25 on top, right? Or do you say that that it becomes one payment of $125? Does it become one big thing or does it become really two separate things? Okay. And so things like that, you don't have to know anything about the sugyas. You just to say, whenever I say add a fifth, say, is that fifth become one larger payment or is it really two separate payments of the base payment plus the additional surcharge of the fifth? Okay. So, and there's, you know, other areas, there's these common svaras in a certain sense that like the first time you learn the sugya, okay. The problem with those types of svaras are, they're very broad, they're very universal, and like you can very easily stuff them into any kind of machlokas. Almost like whenever the first sugi you learn in shutfus, you're gonna think, I have a machlokas, Rav and Shmuel. I don't know exactly what the machlokas is. And you're gonna say, you know what? I have a chakira. How is shutfus? Do you both own the full thing or you both own parts of it? And just like, or the same thing with chomish, you're just gonna, these universal svaras that you just start off with, which weren't based on any particulars, you all of a sudden you can basically almost always fit them into any set of facts. I shouldn't say any set of facts, but they're very often the first svari machlokas you come up with, habamina maskana, machlokas rishonim, tanayim, doesn't make a difference. These things work. And the reason they work is because they're so broad, you can kind of fit them anywhere. So we call them, you know, or Fader and I call them master keys, because they basically open up any lock and you can kind of use them to kind of answer any machlokas. Okay. The problem is, and this is what we were discussing yesterday, is that the reversibility of the svaras. The fact that you could basically very often you could flip them and say, no, I know I said Rav holds everybody has full bialos, and Shmuel holds it's a partial bialos, everybody owns partial, but you could even flip them and say no, the opposite, right? I don't get the complicated what we did yesterday, it was a little complicated. But you could flip it, say really reverse the sheet does, and say still, even though Rav held the other way, which was a little bit less intuitive that he would hold that way and still say this, you could still argue in that other way of learning, you could still make a further hakira, and same thing with Shmuel. And once you could flip the sides, even if one side sounds better, even if it's simpler to take this universal hakira and say Rav holds this way and Shmuel holds this way, so even though that's more appealing to you intuitively, but if logically you could say each one holds the opposite, then that's not a good place to find that hakira. That's not a good place for the master key. So in a certain sense, it becomes the lazy way of going, of just taking these broad machlokasim and then stuffing it everywhere. And I've seen people learn that way, where basically they just take these broad universal machlokasim and then they say, look, this universal hakira, that's the machlokas Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Shmuel. And that becomes machlokas Rav and Shmuel. And that explains the Rashi Tosos. And look, it goes all the way down to Shulchan Aruch HaRamah. Basically, this one hakira, we've explained the whole sugya. We've lined up all these shitas. The Rashba and the Ramban are in this camp, and the Rambam is in this camp, and everything works out. Basically, you have this one hakira, and you basically try to pick everybody onto the two different sides, figuring out how everybody goes according to this hakira. And every problem in the sugya, you answer with this hakira, and that becomes the way they learn. Okay? So that's really bad learning. That's not a good way to learn, you know? Because it's fake. There's a certain fakeness to it. And when we first started doing Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, we thought he was doing that. So it sounded bizarre. But then you pay a little more attention, you realize he's doing almost exactly the opposite. Is he was starting with these universal hakiras, these master keys, and then he was going through the sugya and showing you would think you could do this with Rav and Shmuel. And that's not true, because you could argue really reverse it. Really, Rav doesn't have to hold that. Shmuel doesn't have to hold that. And right? He was almost showing you that it's the sugya starts off simple with basic questions, but then when you try to apply it, it gets messy and it gets complicated. It's not as simple as you think. Okay, so that in a certain sense was what he was doing when he was learning. It was kind of interesting what he was doing. It's not quite what I do and what Rebbe does. We start from the other direction and ends up a very different place. But the problem with the universal questions is that you end up being able to fit them anywhere, and then they become reversible. And very versatile means like each position could really hold the opposite, and you could have a further hakira. Well, then just say that other hakira. You know what I mean? That just shows you you're stuffing. It's a stuff job. You're taking this broad idea and you're stuffing into a svar. That's not a good svar. You want it to be where it's muchach, where it's compelling, that the particular position you're explaining has to hold by that side. And they couldn't have held by the other side. It wouldn't have made sense for them to do it. That's the kind of svar that you're looking for. A svara that's reversible is not really a good svara, you know, to some degree. If it's very compelling that it's mistaver, that one side holds one and one side holds the other, and, you know, it's a dochak thing to really force the, you know, them to say the other side, then that's, you know, I guess that's good enough. And I guess different people have different positions where they're happy with it. But the general idea is you don't want to have a very broad general hakira that you're just applying to the Havamina Maskan, applying to the Machlokas. But in the end of the day, conceptually, it's logical to have reversed it. And each side could have said the opposite with a further hakira. That means that your original svar was not a good definition. You were just taking a master key and applying it to this lock. We're looking for the particular locks. We're looking for the specific svara that explains this particular sugya without making recourse to the broad general hakiras of the whole sugya. There's no flaw in what Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is doing. You can't be wrong about a master key. You can't be wrong about that hakira. Like conceptually, it's either one way or the other, right? Like lechor, you would think. You're not wrong. There's a hakira out there. Question which way it is. You know, one of the great things about like the Grizz or Chaim or like whatever is that they're able to prove one of those sides. They know how to bring a raya to really show you one of them is right or one of them is wrong. You know, that it knocks out a possibility. You know what I mean? Like they can show you from these types of, they can prove hakiras. But like a true master key, really, the real answer is that you can learn the sugya both ways. Do you know what I mean? In general, you can basically learn the sugya through either way. And that's to some degree what Rav Aaron is showing you. he's showing you that, like, you can take this way of looking at Shutfus and learn the whole sugya that way. You can look, take this way of learning Shutfus and learn the whole sugya that way. Do you know? And you saw this for Shmuel is this way. Yeah, but Rob could even still agree with Shmuel that Shutfus is looked at as a full bialis and still argue because of this concept. So it's almost like the key is almost to show you that broad chakira, it's in a sense so broad that you can learn the sugya both ways. I don't quite know why he does it. He just seemed, again, I did like 4 or 5 pieces of his. It seemed like everyone, he was doing this. But maybe it was just like the safer I got. I don't know. I'm using it more as illustration, not because I'm an expert in how he learns. I wouldn't recommend learning that way. I'm more talking about it because like it happens. You don't realize it happens. When you sit back and think and you try the more creative, intuitive approach, you end up with master keys. That's usually what happens. You just end up because you're just trying to think about the area. So you just end up with the broadest ideas. So if you're going to do that, you have to be aware of the danger. That's my point, is you're going to get stuck. When you try to do the step-by-step rigorous method, trying to go one step after the other, what do I have to say? You're going to get frustrated. You're going to get stuck. And that's okay. Go as far as you can. Then you're going to want to sit back, do the creative analytic, creative intuitive method, coming up with an idea, which is fine also. You just have to be aware of the danger that you're going to very often come up with an idea that's so broad that, and you're going to be attracted, it's going to be attractive to you to take that idea and stuff it back into what the problem you're working on. But it's a decent chance that you came up with a really, you got to be careful with that. You have to make sure that your intuition, which brought you to this idea, when you bring it back down, you have to make sure it really fits. You're not just taking something that could fit anywhere. You want the specific lock to the specific key. You're not looking for the key that opens up all locks. That's no good. It's good to know about those keys. It's valuable to understand in any area what the universal chakiras are. Okay, but you don't want to keep applying that svar over and over and over. That's not good. Then you're just not really getting anywhere. You're just taking the same chakir and just keep applying it over and over. And that's not really definition. It's not really the machlokas because logically, especially because you could reverse it, things like that. That's what shows you it's improper. So I'm not saying to do this as much as there is this idea of stepping back, using a more intuitive way of thinking about an area, trying to come up with a way to look at it, just thinking about the area. How are the different ways to formulate it? It's worthwhile. It opens up your mind to possibilities. You should do that in an area. I'm more just pointing out that when you do that and you come up with some chakira, which you will, right away, you know, very, 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 very easy, after a couple minutes, you should be able to find the basic, most basic question. You should be aware that that's probably not the direct solution to the problem that you were thinking of. So that's the point. There's the methodology of step-by-step analytical steps is the flow of the idea itself. It really is, in a certain sense, what you're looking for in the end of the day, but it's just hard to come up with it in advance. It's something that you kind of look back retrospectively. The method you actually think by very often is you go there, you get stuck, then you take a step back, you try to think creatively, intuitively. It's like jumping, it's like taking leaps. You're not taking step by step, you're taking leaps. But then you can end up in a place that doesn't really help you. You have to be careful once you get to a svara, that when you come back and you try to apply it back, that it really fits. You know, in the end of the day, you want to use the creative intuitive thinking to come up with an idea, but then when you apply it and bring it back down, you want to be able to chart out that path up the mountain, step by step, where it really flowed. You don't want to have intuitive leaps in the end of the day. You want to be able to see how one step leads to the other. But like, you, it's just very hard to proceed in that direction. Until you know where you're going. So you kind of use the creative intuitive approach to jump and to cross into areas where to some degree, it's speculative. You're using your speculative creative faculty in order to arrive at an idea you couldn't arrive at in a rigorous manner. But then once you get that idea, don't be content to just apply it in a lazy manner. Come back down and see, now can I see how this idea and these problems in the sugya really point to this is the concept. You know, so that's why when a Brisker writes a piece, or when your Rebbe presents a shir, it's going to sound much more. He always wants to present it. You know what I mean? Nobody wants to present it in this creative, intuitive, speculative manner. That's not a good shir. So he's always going to be much happier if he can present it in a way where it's like step by step. You can go, you can follow each step, and it's clear and it's muchach and everything is compelling how it emerges, and there's no speculation going on. The problem is, what I'm saying is when you have a shiur like that, there's something misleading about it, because that's not how he came up with the idea very often. He didn't come up with it that way. It's just being presented to you in that way.